Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of Mastering Dungeons, at least in the top 10, I hope, of your favorite podcasts out there. And we are here to talk more games. I am here, as I am always here, with one Teos Abadia. Hey, Teos, what is up?
Ceiling. It's no, what has been going on? Ooh, you know what's really up? I managed to play me some Aliens this thanks to one of our Patreon members, Megan J, who is a great DM, ran several of us on our Discord through an alien scenario, Chariot of the Gods, and it was really freaky. A lot of things went wrong. I had one of those
happen,
like,
right?
What's that?
That's what's supposed to happen?
But it's still, you know, it hurts when it happens and mentally. And I did have a really nice moment where, like, I had to pilot a ship, you know, before it all blew up kind of thing. And that was kind of fun. But we got through part one, and we've got more to come. And I'm really excited about it because it was super fun.
Sweet. I received in the mail my copy of Citadel of the Unseen Sun.
Me too.
The full pack. Wow.
That
I
is
didn't
gorgeous.
Realize that is a lot.
Like that
I'm
big.
I'm on chapter 5 of 6 in my home campaign, and now I can use all the tokens and the maps.
Nice.
And oh, I can't wait to bust that out. But that was a heaping helping of content from Ghostfire Gaming. So looking forward to
I
using
mean,
it.
Content is such a bad word for how great that thing is, because it is. Oh. Yeah, it's really impressive. Beautiful. That all the covers, the attention, the layout, the art type stuff. I mean, it's the kind of thing you just want on your shelf because it's just beautiful. And that golden sun color that everything is, really nice. Well yep. done, Ghostfire Gaming.
Even the 3D bookmark
yes.
freaked me out. I was like, wait, it's moving. What? Oh, my. It's double-sided. Whoa.
I actually meant to bring that on the show and hold it up for the people who can see the show. But
I got it right here.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, look at that. And it is like, yeah, it's all like, I don't know, it radiates weird 3D-ish yeah. qualities when you're looking at it in person, which is very cool.
It's really cool. It's really cool. But speaking of really cool, we have some really cool listeners out there, and sometimes they ask us questions. So we are going to answer some of those questions right now.
Question one, what's wrong with you?
So much, as we've already discussed before we started recording. But let's hear from George PR via Mastodon. When designing a game, what are the trade-offs and design considerations for a character gaining more hit points as they advance versus having a set of number of hit points or wounds from the start? Relatedly, why does D&D 5e have you gain hit points each level? So a couple different questions there. I'm going to let Teo start this question off.
Yeah, I mean, so I think the simplest answer is that historically it went in that direction as a way to give you something to strive for, right? This is the idea you would go up in level and you would gain things. And one of the ideas is you gain more resiliency. But from a game perspective, what you're able to do when you have that is you now have a greater breadth of threats you can apply to the characters and situations you can apply to the characters, because they can handle it, right? Like if you imagine a game where everybody has one hit point, and Shadow Dark's a little bit like this, everything kills you, right? And in fact, one time when I played Shadow Dark at zero level, it didn't matter what I rolled for damage, they were dead, you know? Mm-hmm. And so all threats were terrible threats. You couldn't have a scary beholder, or it was all just scary. And that shrinks the latitude of what you can do. Now, Shadow Dark does have levels. You do gain hit points over time. And D&D, of course, does. And many games do, but some don't. And in those games, then everything you face has to fit within that band. And that design has to do a lot of work up front to be resilient enough to cover all the play of a campaign and all the ups and downs, right? How do you represent the easy monster, the easy encounter, the hard thing when it's all in that one band? What do you think, Chun?
Yeah. It's as characters advance, how do you want them to feel threatened or be threatened? If you don't advance their hit points, then you have to make lower level monsters not as likely to hit them because they're going to do the same amount of hit points. And so you could do it that way. Or you do it the way it's done most of the time, which is 2,000 commoners shooting crossbows at a dragon are going to hit that dragon 5% of the time. 5%. Oh, here I said I can't think, and I'm going to try to do large amounts of math in my head,
Some number, some
right?
small number.
Right. So we'll say 100. 100 hit for a D8. That's 100 D8 of damage done to this dragon. Should the commoners be able to kill the dragon? If you say yes, then you're all set there. If you say no, you need to find a way for that dragon to survive 200 crossbow bolts. Now, that could be hit points. It could be some sort of damage reduction, damage resistance. You could do lots of different things, but you have to keep all of that math and all of that story-focused rules development in mind. So by doing bonded accuracy, we're saying that you are going to be hit more, even by lower level creatures, if you're a higher level character. So you can make 50 kobolds a threat to a 15th level character, in terms of them damaging. And that's where that design comes into play.
Yeah, and the other thing that's just that games where you have something to strive for as g in gaining levels are exciting. That's why we see the concept of leveling and experience across everything, right? You see it in all kinds of apps that aren't even games, right? Like you gain XP, and it's like, well, okay, you are a level 17, I don't know, Excel user. Like that wouldn't shock us anymore, right? Because it's such a common parlance. And in the D&D space or in any game, you have to think of, well, what am I giving you every level? And hit points just becomes an obvious thing, then can fit into that scale of threats. And part of the trick there is that it won't become meaningless. Like I think fourth edition was a little on the edge where, I'm fighting a goblin skull reaver, and then I'm fighting a goblin whatever that's like a tougher version, elite goblin skull reaver. Am I still playing the same exact encounter, really, where all of us have moved sliders up? You don't want it to feel too much that way. D&D has an asset, which is that it has historically awesome monsters, Red Dragon, Beholder, Displacer Beast, Gelatinous Cube, at various levels of play, Pit Fiend, that you want to encounter. So even though the numbers might all be sliders or somewhat can be argued as sliders, the excitement of the coloring of it, the skinning of it, keeps you going, and then you can add fun monster things, the whip, the pit fiend, that kind of stuff.
So I hope that that very brief description of why hit points rise in some games, I hope that helps. From Gaffer Dyer via Mastodon, for those TTRPG groups who continue to play 5e for the foreseeable future, how many do you think will just continue to use the 2014 PHB as their base rules? I assume the answer will vary based on demographics. So paraphrasing something else Gaffer said, for me, 2014 is likely to be the default due to high switching costs of getting my group all and onto the new books. Yes. Here's the thing. We were told that the rules would be compatible, and I have a feeling that is the truth. I think you could take a class from the 2024 books, play them alongside a class with the 2014 books. The rules will be similar enough that everyone could have a session. What's the difference then? The difference is the small things. One of those small things is a big thing, which is the power level. So if you get two groups playing, I'm playing the 2024 Barbarian, I'm playing the 2014 Barbarian, great, that's fine, we can all play. And then the 2014 Barbarian player looks at what the 2024 Barbarian is doing and says,
I want weapon
yes, the
mastery.
rules are the same, but, huh. And maybe it's, I want my weapon mastery, and maybe it's, I don't care about weapon mastery. And I think we're going to talk a little bit more about that later. But so do I think some groups will stay? Yes. Do I think gr some groups will move forward? Absolutely. When you start mixing it, though, that's when it will come to a comparison. And if you want a slightly more power focused, a slightly more, dare I say, complicated game, especially in terms of combat, then you are going to want to move forward to the 2024 rules. And that's sort of expected. I think that's baked into the design, if you will, and the marketing.
I mean, at the individual group level, I think that's exactly the kind of thing that's happening, right? You just need one player in a group to start kind of delving into it and it becomes interesting, or you buy the new book, right? Like they have said they're going to remake Tasha's and Xanathar's because they're robbing enough parts for it to put into the core that they'll remake them. Well, when they remake those, you're going to be expected to buy them. Well, now they're different and they're going to play off of the core books. So what do you want to do? Do you want to like not buy them? Do you want to buy them and kind of try to mishmash it in? Or are you going to go to the new core books? And those are the decisions that invested active players have to do. But you know, the question of do I think people will advance, or let's see, the actual phrasing was how many do you think will just continue? I think in this situation, it kind of doesn't matter. Or maybe this specific question doesn't matter, right? Because of that compatibility, especially. So if you want to keep doing 2014, no problem at all for Wizards, if you're willing to buy stuff. If you were to switch to 2004, stay on 2014 and stop all purchases because you consider everything new to be not you, that then would be an actual problem. But if you want to stick to 2014 and still buy the new adventures and buy the t-shirts and pay for the D&D Beyond and the whatever, I think Wizards is A-OK with that because their game should be bringing new players in and expanding the audience. That's how you get those millions of players' handbooks sold. So that's the main, that should be the eyes on the prize, right?
And that brings a question about D&D Beyond. Is will they continue to support the 2014 classes, or if you cr go create a new character, will it just update you with the basic rules, with the free rules? Will that update to, if there are free basic rules for the 2024 book? Is that what new players will see when they for free go in to make a new character?
And yeah,
It's a
will the basic rules be updated, right? When I asked about that D&D Beyond question, right, of how are you going to handle these changes, right? Are you going to have the chill touch 2014, chill touch 2024, clearly labeled as they did with the Mordenkainens versus the the multiverse monsters versus the older Volos and so on. And really, like there were a lot of people in the room and they all got these looks of like a very genuine, I don't think there were that many actors in the room. I think they really didn't know and they hadn't thought about it. And so one presumes that they have now thought about it. I sure hope so. But I don't know what that answer is, right? Because one must think through the day 2024 core books drop, can I still buy a 2014 player's handbook? And how is it represented in the system? And they'll have to figure that out to keep it all straight.
And that's one of the things that having a siloed system of studios or whatever is a problem, right? You get your particular focus and you go to it and you do the best job you can, and no one at D&D Beyond ostensibly is thinking about that because they're working on their D&D Beyond stuff. And that falls then to the managers to think about those things. And the managers, while they may be great managers, aren't necessarily experts in the things that both sides of this silo are doing. So they're not thinking
Like,
at
here's
thinking
a question to just, like is scary. When I put on my tech project manager kind of hat is, hey, is the virtual tabletop going to handle 2014 stats? Because you're going to have all this player base that says it's compatible, you should support it. So I want to use the 2014 Goblin, not or the 2024 or both.
Right. Yeah,
Like,
it's a thing,
it'll be
and
interesting.
we will see the ramifications of that as 2024 continues, ends, and we get into 2025. Finally, from my friend Martin Hughes, Via Morse code, I'm going to go with. I was going to go with Semaphore. Martin is our wonderful graphic designer at Ghostfire Gaming, and he had a couple questions for us. One, do you both feel that people playing Baldur's Gate are having an impact on D&D currently? My answer is absolutely. It's just a matter of what that impact is. What exactly is it affecting? I think it's definitely affecting an understanding that D&D as a brand does have some power, does have some heft. And so it will encourage more partnerships, more ways to introduce D&D through other means and other media. Is it affecting the game itself? Probably a bit, not greatly, but as designers and as players who play both, play through the game and see, oh, it's really cool that this spell does this way here. Oh, I wish D&D did that. That is going to, at some point, filter back to the design team or to third-party designers who can leverage that free market research to push things in the direction that people love and recognize.
And my answer is it's huge because you now have another enormous, like, wide number of people that are exposed to D&D through yet another angle, or you have the Stranger Things, you have a couple of other shows like that, and then you have this Baldur's Gate phenomena to where not only do people already know what D&D is, but now they're interacting with it. Even if it's not quite the game, it's pretty darn good. And what I've seen at two conventions recently, and in Seattle that I ran the D&D for new players, is a vast understanding, really widespread understanding of Baldur's Gate 3 as their kind of expression of what D&D is when they are new. And we're talking with, hundreds and hundreds of players coming in and trying the game. And we would make a joke, like we would stand outside to try to get in some new people in just on the hallways, and we would say things like, it's like Baldur's Gate 3, but with real people. And everybody laughs. I mean, everybody understands the joke. And I didn't think that would be the case when we started making the joke. And boy, it plays out because everybody understands that game if you're in those kinds of gaming circles. And that's an amazing asset to have that will endure, right? That'll last for a long time, bringing people into our hobby.
And as we are going to report, or maybe not, no, we're not going to report it, so I'll report it right now. Fallout, the RPG, sold out, thanks to Fallout, the TV show. And we are seeing more and more of people gravitating toward a role-playing game, whereas before they wouldn't have. And the younger folks who I teach or talk to keep bringing up how much their generation loves media that they can be involved in. It's great to watch a show, but they want to be a part of it, whether that's in a chat room discussing what they're watching, or as a video game where they can insert their own character into the story that's being told. And we're seeing more and more of it, and Baldur's Gate 3 will be another step in that process for D&D.
Yeah, absolutely.
The second question Martin asks is, when playing RPGs, do you have a preferred beverage or snack? What you got going for us, Travis?
I like a dark beer. I like Chicago Mix. That's the whole, popcorn, caramel, covered corn, peanuts.
I like a good cider. And I like jelly beans. I was reintroduced to jelly beans at the table a couple of weeks ago, and oh, they're addictive. They're not good for you, but my
Yeah, no, they're
gosh.
delicious. I love jelly beans. I deliberately stay very far away from them most of my life.
Yeah, me too. I would never buy them, but they end up in the house somehow, and
Wonderful.
it's not pretty. And being from jolly old England, Martin also lets us know that Wembley Arena has a 12,500 capacity, whereas Wembley Stadium, which is the national large stadium, can hold 90,000 to 100,000 people, depending on if it's all seating or if they're standing. So when we said that Critical Role sold out Wembley Arena, that was that 12,000 seat arena, not the 90 to 100,000 stadium.
And I was reading that Madison Square Garden holds, under 20,000, and it varies by event. So like hockey's like 18,000, NBA is 20, and they can play it with it a fair bit. And so my guess is for a show like that, they may, reduce it somewhat. But either way, these are all impressive numbers, right? That's all win.
So thank you, Martin. Thank you for listening. And we are now going to get to our news and commentary section, where we are going to begin with the aforementioned D&D Beyond, because it has updated its marketplace. Thank you to one of our patrons, Tom Dunn, for noticing this change. And tell us, Teos, what did Tom point out to us?
Yeah, Tom pointed out, and then it became a big deal. Like it started to be discussed on the D&D Beyond Discord, which is the D&D Discord, and it got pretty heated because not only was it a revised look and feel to be more of this marketplace type situation, but it added features and then it removed some things. So, for example, you can now purchase digital and physical books directly from D&D Beyond. Whereas before it would say, here's this physical book, go off and buy it somewhere else. They might have bundled it for a new introduction, a new product coming in, like Book of Many Things. But now it is you most of these products have the ability to purchase both directly from them. This is not true for partner products. Sorry, Ghostfire, sorry, Cold Press, and so on. But the incremental cost varies by product. So I looked at a couple. Deck of Many Things is $30 for the digital, $80 for both. Tasha's is 30 digital, 50 for both. And those are pretty reasonable savings for digital and physical bundles. And if everybody rewinds their brain, you'll think back to a time when we were all like, why can't you buy a bundle of the digital and the physical? And that was not possible for a really long time. Now it looks like this is really being implemented as a standard. But they removed the ability to purchase subclasses, feats, and all that kind of thing a la carte. So this ability to just purchase an item has gone. And so fans are pretty unhappy about that. A D&D Beyond representative said, a la carte purchases are no longer supported. However, any individual items you previously purchased, you're going to keep on using kind of thing. They also removed, it seems, legendary bundles where you could get everything for a highly discounted price. That seems to be gone. Maybe they saw it as being just untenable over the long term to maintain it. The short summaries for each book have these sort of like icons, including the edition of D&D they're written for. And that makes you wonder, are they going to maybe shift things that are on DM's Guild to now also be available here? That would be interesting. Are they going to tag 2024 differently than 2014? Unclear. But there's some potential, right? There's the flexibility there of sort of some interesting things happening because they did for some reason bother to list the edition, and that's an interesting thing. The other thing I heard through Discord was a warning that if you already own a product, in the past it was very clear of saying you own this. So it would, I think, basically couldn't buy it, right? Because you already own it. Now, because it's not just thinking of things digitally, it doesn't know whether you, it seems to have forgotten, it no longer tracks whether you own something or not. So you can take a product you already own, place it in your cart, buy it. It will at no point say to you, you own this, and you could end up owning the same thing more than once for no actual benefit, including purely digital. So you got to be a little more careful about that. It's not just going to tell you that you own something or don't own something.
Interesting. We also have news from Hasbro about their continued investment in video games. So Dan Iob, Hasbro's head of digital development, gave an interview to gamesindustry.biz on their video game plans. It notes that Monopoly Go and Baldur's Gate 3 were huge successes, but they were externally developed by Scopely in the case of Monopoly Go, and Larian Studios in the case of Baldur's Gate 3. Iaub has stated that Hasbro has over $1 billion in games being developed right now. Now, the company itself, Hasbro itself, owns four different AAA studios: Atomic Arcade, that's working on the G.I. Joe Snake Eyes game, a Montreal-based developer designer called Invoke Studios that's working on an unspecified D&D game. There are two Austin-based studios, Skeleton Key, that is working on, quote, something spooky, and Archetype, which is run by James Olin, and they're working on a completely new franchise called Exodus. And the quote about this was, "What we're trying to do there is have the tail wag the dog a little bit and have things going the other direction for the company, which would be something new where we can create a new IP through video games and then take advantage of that size and scale that Hasbro has to do other things with it as well." So now, instead of licensing out D&D to other game developers, game studios, they want to make something that they can license out to, oh, let's say Netflix, to make the new, whatever shit
Like
series
Arcane
about
kind of
this,
thing.
about the Exodus franchise. And so that's very interesting, and it shows how much more revenue that a video game company makes as opposed to a tabletop role-playing game company. It's not even in the same stratosphere. I was doing some research that said that in 2023, it was estimated that every tabletop role-playing games and everything involved in that made $1.5 billion. And I thought, that sounds high, but if you add everything, if you add all the digital tabletops and all the accessories and minis and all of that, I could see that getting to 1.5 billion. Whereas Monopoly Go made 2 billion in 10 months. So that shows you the scope and the scale of these two industries. And I am not surprised at all that Hasbro, and by extension, Wizards of the Coast, is leaning very, very hard into video game investment.
And what's different here, Sean, is that the yes, they can have this enormous success in revenue. What gets interesting is the profit side of things and the risk side of things, right? So you have to invest heavily to do that, right? Long development times for all these games. You can run into problems any of many ways on trying to run these products and build things. I mean, even when we look at Baldur's Gate 3, we had delays at multiple time periods. We had the prequel version come out, or what would you call it? The early edition
Beta.
came out. And people were not all that impressed with it, right? It was a lukewarm reception, and that was like a year before they finally got the game out. And then it was the smash success. I mean, you wouldn't have guessed it based on all the troubles, right? We also have heard of, and this article talks a few times, a few talks about one example where in the 1990s, Hasbro set up what's called Hasbro Interactive Division, and it acquired Atari as the brand and MicroProse to build retro-themed games, and then it sold that in December 2000, right? So 10 years later, having not gotten a lot of benefit out of it. And if you follow our show, we've covered in the past how Hasbro made all these major hiring and buying decisions in the video game sector in 2021, right? So this is now for 3 years that we've been at this. And in 2022, CEO Chris Cocks said there are at least six D&D games in development. That's a long time where only one of those has come out, right? A lot of the studios you mentioned, or those studios you mentioned, they were there back then, being developed and invested in, burning all of that money that 1 billion represents. And then in 2023, Wizards of the Coast shuttered at least five video game projects and laid off a number of people and closed off partner studio relationships and others. That was a big deal, right? And then Dark Alliance came out, and that was a disaster, lost money. And now with Baldur's Gate 3 and Monopoly Go, it's all turned around and we're all super enthusiastic. Well, how long will that enthusiasm last? It depends, right? The next thing to come out could really decide that for us, whether it's going to be seen as a success to keep investing in, or do we backpedal? Mm-hmm. Who knows?
Yep, it's true. And you like to think that you mitigate the risk by putting money into four different projects that gives you each a chance to hit that $2 million right promised land with that Monopoly Go hit. So it's definitely something that we will be keeping an eye on, because we like video games and we like games in general, but it also does impact the role-playing game industry. So we will follow along with that. On the tabletop side of things, the Tabletop Game Designer Association is launching. What is that? It is a 501c6 nonprofit organization dedicated to supporting tabletop game designers of all types of tabletop games, including board games, role-playing games, card games, miniatures games, and others, whether it's mass market, specialty, or hobby. So this is something that you can join if you are a tabletop game designer of any of those types of games, to get access to resources and events, such as looking over contracts for you to point out any potential problems, trying to get more recognition for game designers, like getting names on boxes for board games, or getting names on books for published book publishing games, and to help dispute any resolutions that tabletop designers may have with their work.
It's pretty neat. I looked at their designer resources section, and it is nice to see, you know, top three things to ask for in a publishing contract and licensing checklist. It's very board game focused in a lot of ways.
Yes.
With a, you know, tip towards the wider tabletop, but it's definitely, you know, you look at the list of people involved or anything like that, it's definitely a strong board game piece. But they've got still really interesting information, you know, what conventions can you go to and what are national organizations out there, and international organizations, online communities that you can reach out to. So there's a lot here to look at, really worth going there and at least taking a look at the resources that may be useful. But these are common questions. I mean, I've had a lot of folks over the years that have said to me, hey, if I'm creating a board game, what do I do? Like, what do I look for in a partner? How do I approach that? And so it's nice that they're going through and trying to answer some of that up front, and then creating the large organization that over time hopefully can support creators better.
There you go. For $80, you can get an early access membership to all of those things. There's also I think it's a $70 or a $60 associate membership, which gets you access to some of the things, but no voting rights within the organization. So you can check that out at www.ttgda.org. AI is back in the news here with Wizards of the Coast. Why are they talking about AI now, Teos, and what are they saying?
Well, there have been some events recently, and I haven't followed it super detailed, but there have been more events that caused Wizards to decide to put together an FAQ for the wider companies that are under it. So you have here on this new webpage, which is part of the Wizards support site, you can get to this FAQ, and it has links to statements for both Magic and D&D. It tries to answer likely questions you may have. It's got an interesting tone to it. In some ways, it's like you could almost put like "you bonehead" at the end of every statement. It comes off a little defensive. But it says things like, you know, Wizards may not respond to social media or other inquiries regarding whether something is AI, though they're going to look into things. But sort of like, you know, look, we don't have to defend ourselves in every single accusation where someone thinks one of our pieces of art looks like it's AI generated. And we don't have to respond to every question you ask. And it's true, they don't, right? Like they don't have to do that. And it's an interesting discussion that we have in a world where so many pro, I mean, every software I own, I feel like, is saying to me, now with the power of AI, and here's wizards trying to say, no, we didn't use AI again. And then sometimes they find they did, which, of course, is the worst part. But they say, and they also say, we're not going to disclose if, when, or why we decide not to work with an artist, nor whether that's for some time period. You know, they might go back and work with them in the future. And they just try to, I think, in a lot of ways, say, look, we have to maintain some flexibility. And a real quote that captures this is, they have a question at the end. If there is only one takeaway I should have from this FAQ, what should it be? And the stated answer is, human beings are fallible, whether it is a conglomerate of human beings like a company or single human being like an artist. And a lot of it seems to be that, right? Like, this is sort of a cry for, please have some patience around the fact that this is complicated and difficult. We're trying to do what we can. Here are these links to what we're doing. You know, we can't handhold you and answer your every question.
Right. I mean, but before that, though, they did say, listen, we ask our artists not to use AI. We have new documents that we send them to say specifically what they can and cannot do. So we're not changing our stance on that. It's just this. Sometimes artists send us things and we have no way of checking. So it goes, and we will take care of it. We're just not going to answer every single. And it's also important to remember that Wizards of the Coast and any company may hire outside firms, marketing firms, outside firms to do lots of different things, event management, et cetera, et cetera. And while Wizards can say, you know, please don't use AI art, then that's one more step removed, because that marketing company may hire an artist that uses AI art, even when they're not supposed to. So it's a mess that is very hard to resolve. And I think this FAQ, just as Teo said, while maybe taking on a tone of exasperation, it might be well-founded that, yes, we're against AI art, but we also have to get on with our business. Yeah. And so here's where we stand.
Yeah, I mean, you know, for my work, my day job, I have to often create presentations. And one of the things that you can do these days is very quickly pull in all this stock art, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know where Microsoft's getting this stock art from. And it could be AI generated or not. And I, you know, I don't have the time in creating a PowerPoint to think through my slide deck's art sources. It's also very throwaway, where I'm using this very quickly to do a presentation that's going to be gone, but I don't have the time to go through all the steps. And you can imagine how this is true in various different organizations that are creating things for other people. You know, it's a short ad campaign, whatever. And probably three steps down, you know, is that company that you're employing with that's creating this marketing piece going to use something, you know, who knows? Mm-hmm. Very hard to tell, especially when all of their tools, because I can tell you every tech tool I have is trying to tell me how it's unlocked the power of AI. And they are at the opposite side of tagging things as AI generated. They're trying to tell me the whole thing is, even when it isn't, right? Because they think that sells. So it's difficult.
Yep. Now, non-AI related, we're getting to our creator corner, starting with the Wandla TV show coming to Apple Plus on June 28th. You want to tell us about this, Teos? This is your wheelhouse right here.
Yeah, I'm very excited about this. I read the Wandla series with my kids, and I enjoyed reading it as well. Congratulations to Tony DiTerlizzi, known for his amazing Planescape and other D&D art, his Spiderwick Chronicle books and all that, and the Wandla series of novels that he wrote, which is the story of a girl who grows up in a very strange, mysterious, futuristic base, and she's being taught things by a robotic mother. So there is an AI there, I guess. And then she starts discovering things about the larger world. And this is a great series of novels, highly recommend it. And then it's going to be a TV series animated by Skydance Animation with a star-studded cast doing the voices. There's 7 episodes in the first season. DiTerlizzi was an executive producer. And we've got a link in our show notes to the story where you can read more. But June 28th on Apple TV+, I'm excited about that.
Also exciting is DM David and his blog series. And his recent blog is about player monster symmetry. In this blog, David discusses how D&D's roots had some differences between the rules that applied to monsters and the rules for player characters. He gives that great example of, you're in a dungeon and monsters are using this door all the time, but when the characters get there, the door is stuck and they have to make a check to open it. Later editions, especially when you get to third edition, they impose more symmetry on this player monster relationship so that the monsters and the players are following pretty much the same rules. Now we are getting to more lack of symmetry again. And David points out, like RPGs like Daggerheart do away with this symmetry with the game master rolling a d20 while the players are rolling 2d12 and adding them together. And we're going to talk all about Daggerheart in our second segment today, so hang in there for that. In Numenera, players roll to avoid an attack while game masters don't
Narrate.
roll to hits.
Yeah.
And David also points out that 5e works this way with contests. While a character hides, they roll a stealth check, often against the DC set by the monster's perception, where if a monster is hiding, it's the characters that roll a perception or investigation check in order to figure out if they see them.
Yeah.
So this symmetry versus non, it can be a big deal to certain players. And one of the things about Daggerheart that our game master Chris Nizak said was, I love asymmetrical games. I love it when the players are playing one thing and I'm playing another as the game master. And we can let the best of both worlds instruct our game and instruct our storytelling, as opposed to trying to shoehorn in rules that make it symmetrical, but that don't necessarily make sense or make the game or the story any better for it.
Can you imagine in fifth edition if you had like a dungeon where like the monster runs through a door and then it is stuck when the PC goes up to the players would probably lose their mind and get like so angry. You know,
Right.
it makes me want to just do that just to see reactions.
Good
But it
times.
is, I mean, you know, I found with Numenera, it was frustrating for me that I didn't roll and I didn't sort of use the rules, if you will, because it made it hard for me to remember the rules because the players were doing it constantly and remembering how everything worked. And I wasn't doing that at all. So then they would ask a question or feed off of something on their character sheets, and I felt like I didn't understand the game. And I've been running it, you know, for weeks and I'm still like feeling rusty. And that felt strange to me. And I also didn't like, I'm fine with narrating, but not doing things when they were doing things felt weird and felt off to me. So it's not, you know, yeah, it can be in some ways not for everybody.
Yep, for sure. Now tell us finally about the Oracle Monster Generator, Teos.
Yeah, so it's just launched. By the time you listen to this show, Nord Games' latest project is a deck of tarot-sized cards that help you create cool monsters and situations. And it's pretty neat. They have a free preview you can download by going to their Backerkit website. The cards come in seven categories based on monster environments such as forest, underground, and swamp. And then cards within the categories help you identify the type of monster, what it's doing, its role, a special ability, and an interesting story angle. So you can, if you look at the preview, you can kind of see like, oh, okay, you know, I get this card within the desert environment, and here's what this monster is trying to do, and here's what it does in the area, what it's and something interesting about it, right? And so it really kind of creates you create the whole encounter and color the scene behind all of these monster angles. So very cool. Check it out. It ends on June 6th.
Yep, and you can find that at Backerkit, or you can look at our show notes and click the link. With that out of the way, we get to our main segment here today on Mastering Dungeons. We will continue our delve into the Daggerheart playtest, the new game from Darrington Press and Critical Role. So we've looked at character creation and we've looked at the sort of base rules. And now we're going to dig into what this playtest packet gives you and how you can move forward playing it using the cards and how the game master plays with this set as well. I want to point out that Tom Dunn, our math wizard, if you will, our one of our patrons, looked at the math of the duality dice probability and that the odds of rolling with hope are 54% or 71% with advantage. And then the odds of rolling a critical hit are 8% normally and 16% if you have advantage.
Yeah, and
So
I'm interested to talk about
tickling
to
20% there.
That's a big deal, and I had a if we talk about the Ranger later, I have a thought that goes back to this.
So we are going to look at this playtest packet that you can download for free. What does it contain? It c contains a 316-page rule book that gives you the entire rule set for the game, including all the classes and heritages and everything you need. For each class, there is a 20-page packet that you can hand to players. That includes guide for character creation, a character sheet, a guide for reading the character sheet, a two-column cradle, I call it, that you can put on each side of the character sheet with arrows pointing to give you help on how to play that character. There's a full equipment guide. There's ancestry cards for all the ancestries, community cards for all the communities. And then ability cards for 10 levels of the two different domains for that character class. And then also subclass foundation and subclass mastery cards. So that 20-page packet is for each class. So you hand each player this 20-page packet. There are sheets that you can write your loadout and your vault cards on. And then the DM packet has most of this same information, including the cards for players, as well as a 39-page adventure with a how to teach this game section of that adventure in it, as well as some tokens and some things you can cut out to use at the table to play. So if you download this free playtest packet, you are getting a game and a half right off the bat.
Yeah, and then
This
some.
is Yeah, this is something that you would look at a beginner box set and say, oh, this is cool, but this would be too much for a beginner box set. So
Yeah,
that's what you're
maybe.
getting.
Yeah, and what I love about it is this represents a very good process to holistically look at your own game, and which is very hard to do. I try to do this a lot in projects, and it's really hard to convince companies to devote this kind of time to turn on your new person brain and look at what you've got and say, what do I need to make the most of this? And that character sheet, what was the name you called it?
The cradle.
The cradle is really smart, right? Which is this one piece of paper you can print out and you can hold half of it to a side. And now it's got arrows that line up with your sections of the character sheet to tell you what each of them do. And then move it over to the other side and cover the other half of the character sheet. And what that does is it's a piece of paper you don't need when you've got it. But when you're early on, it's a constant explanation, but without eating up the real estate of the character sheet. That's really brilliant, right? That's really smart. And they have a number of other things like that is really about like, what is it that a person needs to use to grasp this, which is good, because then it allows them to have a little more of that complexity, which they clearly want in their game.
And using this packet, or using the whole playtest bundle, but using this packet, you can make your own beginner set
Oh, yeah.
for your players with pre-generated characters, all these handy add-ons, all the cards. You would have to print
Pretty
them
cool.
and cut them out, but you could do it yourself and run a really interesting session, I would say,
Yeah.
of this game. So for your money, which is
Zero.
$0 and 0 cents, you are getting quite a bit.
Yeah, totally. Absolutely. It's really smart. I mean, it's impressive, and it's nice because at the playtest level, you already feel cared of. So you're kind of excited to see, well, when this comes out, they will probably have that level of care for it too. And that's great.
For sure. So what we want to do now is dig down into certain cards to walk through the abilities that those cards present and how a class is designed to be played for this game. So we're going to start with the domain cards. The domain cards have information on them to help you understand how to play, but also become a part of the design of the game in terms of moving cards around and using cards a specific way.
And I want to
So,
pull,
Teos,
if I can just pull back a second and just say, hold
sure.
on, you're going to sell me cards? If this were D&D, can you imagine the criticism if D&D 6e came out? Right? I mean, we saw it during 4e, right? You start giving out cards and people go, what are you doing to my role-playing game? But we don't treat other companies that way usually. So in fact, if anything, they generally get praised for it. So here we have a situation where, cards aren't just like optional. These are really baked into it, right? And you're going to want to buy these cards, which is monetization, if I dare say so. And they're gorgeous art. They're pretty tangible stuff, right? So it's got a gameplay thing, which fourth edition also had that benefit to it. And then you've got these various sort of like a Magic the Gathering or other CCG game card. You're going to have reproducible icons and things like that. So you get to learn them quickly and you're going to spend them and, either tap them or flip them over, whatever you want to do with it.
Yeah, and when Teo says it's required, it's not required, but it is so much easier to play the game. The game is designed with the understanding that you will have these cards that you will need to switch out, put from your loadout to your vault, and vice versa. And so you can do that on a piece of scrap paper, right? You can do that on a sheet, but it's so much easier just to say, oh, I'm going to put this into my vault and I get in a certain number of points because I do this. And then, oh, I need to take something out. Well, I spend a stress to do that, right? It's a mechanical system that is made easier through the use of cards.
And it's a little more, if for folks who are familiar with 4E, it's a little more flexible than 4E in terms of what it's, or maybe let's say it's a wider scope of what it's trying to do. These cards can represent not just your powers, but general features, but they have some sort of spend to them generally. Some utility, sort of like the utility powers in 4E did, but it's a little wider than that, how often you may be able to use them and what you may be able to do with them.
And we're going to discuss that right now by talking about the domain cards. If you remember from our last show, when you choose a class, you get two domains. So your domains will give you certain abilities that are represented by these cards. And you will have to then make a choice at certain points across the life of your character, what ability from which domain am I going to choose? I can only choose one of these first level abilities from my domain. So do I choose this one or do I choose that one? And once you make that choice, that other card goes away and you will continue to use this card going forward. What is on a card?
And
I'm
before, just
glad you asked.
one more just
Oh,
quick
yeah,
thing to
go ahead.
review is that each class has two domains. The domains are shared, but the combination is unique. So Druid is Sage and Arcana, but someone else, probably Wizard has Arcana, maybe Sorcerer has Arcana, I forget. But you aren't the only one to have one of them. You're the only one that has those two combinations. And so you'll share some powers with other characters at the table potentially.
Yeah. And so if you choose all of the powers from one of these domains, the thief or the rogue could have all the darkness cards, and so could the sorcerer have all the darkness cards. So you could have a sorcerer and a thief or a rogue with the exact same set of power domain abilities, but different things elsewhere from their class that make those mean something else. So what's on a domain card, Teos?
So you have a level that is the maximum level based on your character. So if you're a first level character, you can only choose level one domains. It'll tell you what the domain is. So if it's something like that, arcane or whatever, the different types are out there, you know, bone and shadow and things like that. I don't quote me on those names. So that identifies the maximum, the minimum level requirement and what it belongs to. There is a recall cost. So the way it'll work is you're going to have five domain cards that you've chosen, and some of them will be in your vault. And then you'll have a number in play based on your level. And you can swap between those cards. They said in the rule book that once you reach level five, you'll have more cards than you have space in your loadout. Earlier levels, it's not a big deal, but eventually you have to choose which powers do you want. It's a little bit like if in fourth edition, you remember it, you reach certain levels and you didn't get a new card, you swapped for a power, and you could choose whether you want to keep a lower level power, higher level. It's a little bit like that. So you eventually are having this this vault, and you can swap from your loadout to your vault during downtime without any issue, or you can mark a stress to do it at any point. So even in the middle of a combat, you could suddenly get that other power that you didn't think you'd need and bring it back in. You just take stress to do so, which is interesting, right? It's that whole answers that problem of what if you want to have that utility power that, you know, you only use every now and then. Well, you can keep that in your vault and pay the stress to pull it out. What else, Sean?
Each domain card also has a type. Now, this may not be a big deal right now, but it may be later. So the first type of domain card is called ability. This is the non-magical, the mundane types of powers. So for example, I'm looking at a guardian right now, and one ability is called Forceful Push. So when you make a melee attack, you can, you know, push something and add damage to it. Then there are spell type domain cards, and those will be magical damage and magical consequences of that. And finally, there is a third type called a grimoire. And right now, that is unique only to the Codex domain. So if you look at a card for the Guardian, which is more of a fighter type, it says ability. If you look at a card for a sorcerer or a wizard, it says spell. And if you look at the Codex domain, it says grimoire. Does it mean anything? Not currently, but we are told that some of these mechanics in the game might apply to only one type of card. So there may be a monster, I'm just guessing, but there may be a monster there that is immune to spell cards immune to ability cards. So
or maybe a magic dead zone might not allow some types, things like that. Yeah,
for sure. So I can see ways that you could make those things, make more of them and add mechanics to make those different depending on the situation. And the last thing a card will have is an effect. That's what happens when you use the card. So for example, I'm looking at Bare Bones, which is a first level Valor ability. When this card is in your loadout, if you choose not to equip your armor, you have an armor score equal to 3 plus your level. So it gives you the ability to go without armor, which does things like lower agility, which means you're easier to hit. So different things that you can choose there with those cards.
And we do in this game, it's kind of nice. They put often chapter headings for things that there will be, but aren't there yet. And one of them is called custom domain cards. And so it'll be interesting to see, you know, if they have in mind the idea that you could make your own somehow. It's unclear kind of what that means, but there's a placeholder there in these rules for having that eventually, which is kind of cool.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Now, one of the reasons we're going through this is because I use Demiplane, and I wasn't sure, because I was using the Demiplane interface, what a card was and wasn't, because everything just showed up on your character sheet. Nothing was actually labeled cards In Demiplane, there was a domain effect thing, but I wasn't sure what that actually meant as I was playing. And the whole idea of a vault versus your loadout, I didn't understand because there was a small button that said view vault, but it was off to the side and it wasn't highlighted in the main area. So I had no idea what it was. So I had the assumption that the cards you didn't choose when you created your character or leveled were in your vault and that you could switch them in and out, but that doesn't see appear to be the case.
Yeah. And just to give a couple of examples, right? So here's the Ranger. You have an ability, Death Maneuvers. You can mark a stress to move anywhere within far range without making an agility roll to get there, right? And it has a zero refresh. So you can actually pull this from your vault without paying that cost. And no, pulling the card, you can, what is it? You can re. So it basically doesn't get expended, right? I think that's what that means. Yeah. And so that's an ability. Then you have a spell, Vicious Entangle. Make a spell cast roll against a target within far range. On a success, roots and vines reach out from the ground and temporarily restrain them, dealing d8 physical damage. On a success, you may also spend a hope to temporarily restrain any enemies very close to your target, right? And that's got a one refresh cost, and it's level one power. So that's an example of a spell where you must make the spell cast roll to succeed. It is really like an attack type spell versus a kind of feature that's always on with this Death Maneuvers or Nimble, for example, is an ability for the Ranger. While this card is in your loadout, add half of your agility score to your evasion rounded up. So that's just on, right? You're just boosting yourself. It's not even a choice to use it. It's interesting.
So you're shuffling these cards, not literally shuffling, but you're moving them, during play and as you gain levels. So when I was playing, my second level sorcerer, we had leveled up. My second level sorcerer had a feature called Channel Raw Power that let me place one of my domain cards from my loadout into my vault. And then I could gain hope equal to the card's level, or enhance a damage dealing spell by dealing extra magic damage equal to twice the level of the card. So I could take one of my first level cards, put it into my vault, and either gain one hope or deal two extra damage with a spell. But then I wasn't sure how I got it out. And I didn't know, do I do it during downtime or do the rules that say I could take a stress to pull a card out from my vault, does that apply now? Can I do it right away? Do I need to wait? Right?
Yeah.
All of these questions were sort of looming. And it was a play test. I'm sure my game
Yeah.
master knew the answer or could have found the answer pretty quickly, but it was all sort of confusing to me. And then I wasn't sure if any of that even applied before I was fifth level because there was nothing in my vault to change with.
I think the answer to all that is yes, but part of what's tough is, and you know, and this Daggerheart specifically uses a lot of these keywords that aren't sort of just normal keywords like attack roll. Okay, you know, you don't, if you've played an RPG, you get that. But evasion, hope, fear, stress, your knowledge trait, you know, these kinds of various keywords, sometimes it gets really word soup in this. In these things, in the cards or in other features. And it can be really hard to get the feel of what's happening when there's too much of that because it's not yet rote our understanding of those keywords. And the more and more you get to understand all these things and they all become background knowledge, it'll be easier. But at least initially, I found even reviewing the classes, sometimes I would think, well, okay, what is this feature doing? You know, like both what's the narrative and what is even the gameplay of it? Because of these kinds of things, right? Like you said here, this, all right, I've got channel raw power, that's just the name. But then my domain card, okay, that's these cards, not my ancestry, heritage stuff, this, you know. And then I can make hope equal to the card's level or, you know, this, but I got to put it in the vault. And all those keywords can be a hill to climb, right? That make it a little harder until you've got all these rules down.
And even when you get the rules down, what is it? The human brain can only remember seven things at once, right? Was that the last stat I heard? I
I
will
can't
never
remember.
remember loadout. If they don't change that word, I will never ever remember it. I will always have to look up what
Yeah.
loadout, what's in play. What is that word? I know vault. Vault, I can
Yeah.
understand. Vault is it's locked away. Loadout, I'm just lost.
Yeah, I
And
mean it's a
it's
very
not.
it's a video gamey thing, right? Your
Yeah.
switch
Yeah.
loadouts, right? And, oh, I'm going to
Yep.
go in as a tank today, or I'm going to whatever. Yeah, it is, and I think that's this game is really treading that line between narrative and finicky, mechanically complex. The payoff will be that if you buy into this stuff and you get to where you all understand it, maybe then all this stuff fades into the background because you gain that expertise and you're having some really awesome fun and then can do these narrating bits on top of it. I mean, I think those of us who made the most of fourth edition loved it because we did exactly that. All of the gobbledygook that annoyed other people was background stuff we didn't care about and just assumed. And we were there role-playing away, having fun, describing our powers with these great, evocative ways and having a blast. Whereas other folks will say that it's way more evocative to just swing your axe every round, right? And so you end up with that. We'll see how Daggerheart does over time with this approach and how that pays off.
Yeah. And speaking of just swinging your axe, at least at second level, with hope being something I needed to spend to do my really strong powers, I was often in the position where just hitting things with my staff, now it was a magical bolt flying from my staff, but it was just my weapon attack. That was often the best thing to do, which felt both bad because I felt like, oh, I can't do these cool things, but also good because it was powerful enough that if I wanted to just hit things with my staff, that was good. That was a viable option. It wasn't so suboptimal that I didn't feel like I was contributing to the action.
Yeah, no, it is really interesting that I think it has that concept of at wills trying to make, the general things you do are good. And it dances between the different classes on how it does these things, right? Some characters, like, the rogue, you're just attacking, except when you choose to do something to trigger your sneak attack, and except when you choose to make an offhand attack, and except, so these exceptions that you may do sometimes, but often you're taking stress or expending hope to do them. And it's got to be a very interesting design challenge to try to keep these balanced and keep them compelling. And I think that's, if we had all the time in the world, we could compare all of the classes and really how they do that. And I think some of them do better than others in their current state at coming off that way as compelling and interesting in terms of the play behind
Right,
them.
because we haven't really even talked about the things that you can do because of your heritage, because of your community, and the way there are, what was it, 9, 20 some of you, I call it species. I
The
don't remember
ancestry, yeah.
ancestry. There were a lot, and each of those had a couple of different powers, and so did the community that you chose could
Yeah,
give you
and in
some
general,
powers.
the ancestries are interesting in that they will often say a thing, but then you have one or two abilities, right? So if I look at fairy, you can take a stress to fly for a number of minutes equal to your level. Once per session, after you are an ally in close range and make an action roll, you can spend three hope to re-roll those duality dice and take the new result. So those are kind of your features. But then in the description, it'll sometimes say things that sound like an ability. And it's like, well, am I supposed to do something with that? Like, is that a thing I can, I forget an example of them, but there are a couple that I was reading recently, and I was like, well, this is the kind of thing you could argue to your DM that you can just do a thing because of how this is described. but it's not a feature, so I don't know if I'm allowed to do it or not. It was interesting.
Yeah, all of those things could interact as a demon. When I rolled with fear, I could mark two stress to make it a roll with hope instead, which can interact in interesting ways with a character that really relies on hope to power things. And then as an Orderborn, if I once per short rest, if I described how I was embodying my principle through my action, I could roll a d20 as my hope die instead of a d12. So again, that's pretty powerful stuff mechanically, whereas the Slyborn is just you have advantage on rolls where you're negotiating with criminals, detecting lies, or finding a safe place to hide. So those two things for to me are quite a difference in the mechanics there.
So I found one of them, halfling. This is similar to what you're saying. Halflings, it says, are naturally attuned to the magnetic fields of the mortal realm, granting them a strong internal compass. That's not a feature, it's just a description. They also possess strong senses of hearing and smell and may be more able to detect those who are familiar to them by the sound of their movements. And it's like, okay, but then their feature is that they give out hope to everybody in the party at the beginning of session. And but I'm like, well, what do I can I argue with to my DM that my that I get to do this? Or the fungrel, it says that they can enables some to communicate with other fungrels across long distances. So can I do that? Because it's not a feature. It's really interesting, right? And how do you balance that out and make that feel fair and to where someone isn't saying, well, can we have some criminals in the adventure so I can finally use my feature?
So yeah, like Teo said, it would be interesting to go through each of these things and balance them against each other, or look for ways that one might be super strong if combined with a specific class or specific abilities or spells from a specific class. But we don't have that time because we want to talk about the action tracker and what that means for the game. So, when combat occurs, an action tracker is used. Players may go in any order they want, but most actions, if you attack or do something that says as an action, you must put an action, a token on the action tracker to show that you have acted. So, players can go in any order. One
And as
player could
often
take
as they
several
want.
turns and as often as they want. They continue until one of these things happen. So the game master does not act until one of these things happen. A player fails on a check they're making, a player rolls with fear, or the game master spends two fear that they've collected. They start with two, and then they can collect fear as players roll with fear. So they can spend two fear to interrupt and begin to take actions. There is an optional variant that has been added that says players will have three tokens and they use those across the entire party and then can get another three. So, in other words, players can only go three times before everyone else can catch up and go three times.
And that's an interesting concept, right? Go whenever you want, but three times. It points, I think, to the interesting difficulty Daggerheart's having in communicating its initiative system, because like Apocalypse World just says, look, you all make the call, right? Should a certain person go, then the DM tells them to go. Does it make sense that now is when another person goes? Well, then that's what happens, and someone can step in at any time, and that's just the way it is. Don't sweat the details. It's not about balance, it's about the narrative. And here we say, well, maybe, you should have these three tokens so that you go. I think that the narrative thing, what's interesting is, in Apocalypse World, if I want to roll several times, likely the GM or do several things. Likely the GM's going to have a monster just react narratively. And that's truly a narrative decision. Here, you may want to go three times in a row or however many times in a row, but you'll probably fail one of those rolls or probably roll with fear. And those dual chances of those things happening actually are pretty high, right? Like, according to Tom, you know, 54% of the time, so 46% of the time, you're rolling fear. And you're going to fail some percentage of the time, too. Mm-hmm. So you may have either of those things happening quite often. And I shared, you know, in the game we played, we had an encounter where every single roll was either a failure or with fear. And that meant the GM was just going all the time. And that really broke things up and kind of both slogged things up a bit and, you know, interrupted pacing a little too much, mm-hmm. but also meant that the players couldn't just have at it and do all of the things they wanted to do.
Right. And what I found was when we played, even we used different colored action tokens to show who has acted. But we might have had one where the same player went twice, pretty much back to back. So there were two of those tokens on the map. And then somebody else acted, they put their token on. But then the game master, as we'll talk about in a minute, can spend those actions to do things. So they would take that token off, but they would take the token off of the player that's acted twice. So then the only token that was on there was the player who had only acted once. So it made it like, oh, well, then this player can act again because their token isn't on there. Wait, they went twice. You just happened to take theirs off. So there's that sort of thing, keeping track of who went. If you're trying to keep some sense of fairness and keeping everyone involved. So it's going to be incumbent on the game master and the other players to sort of police themselves in terms of making sure everyone gets a chance to act.
Yeah, because there's no way the DM's going to know which tokens to pull out of the action tracker. And that is what's interesting, right? The neat concept that's going on here is players putting these action tokens when they act onto the tracker is creating a currency that the GM can spend when you either fail a roll or roll with fear, or if the GM spends fear and the GM now gets to go, then the GM will spend those actions. They'll take those tokens and use those to activate NPCs. So the more that you have gone, the more tokens that there are to fuel the enemies responding. And that's the kind of clever concept that's going on there, that this narratively can swing pretty widely, possibly, right? Mm-hmm. Or at least, and if not much has happened on the PC side, then it can't swing very far, right? I might only have one action token there. You fail, well, I can maybe do one thing as GM. And now we got to go back to players because my monsters literally can't go. And that's an interesting concept. It's going to take, I think, for me to play a lot of games. I'm going to play another game pretty soon coming up. But I think it's going to take a good number of sessions for me to get a feel for how this system works in this way.
Yeah. And we see some of this in D&D, even in fifth edition D&D, right? There's legendary actions. There's reactions. There's those things that let the enemy go when they normally wouldn't be able to. And you could make a version of 5e where creatures get to act on certain initiative counts, but also can act when they hit a certain hit point threshold. Bloodied was a thing in fourth edition that sort of mimicked this idea of story-wise, a trigger happens that lets the enemies go, or even lets the player characters go in certain situations. So it's not unheard of in D&D's history, including current D&D, but it's less malleable than what this presents, which really relies on the game master to decide when it's time to take this step in the story.
And that on that uncertainty piece, it ties, or the monster symmetry piece, sorry. It's very interesting to think about that and apply it to this, because the GM is bound by these action trackers as fuel for their actions. Whereas the PCs can, in theory, if you're not using the optional variant, can go as often as they want, right? They are generating the currency for the GM to go, but the GM is bound by that. So the GM is really responding to the players, but the players are not responding to the monsters. And so it's an interesting lack of symmetry there.
Yeah. And so that asymmetrical aspect, which we talked about in the earlier segment, in our question section, is an aspect of the game that is very much leaned into in this game, as many of the Powered by the Apocalypse games do. We are out of time for this episode, but next time we're going to get into the game master side of things, including what the game master is allowed to do, what they are encouraged to do, and how the monsters of the game can be used in play and in the story. So thank you out there for listening. We do appreciate your support. Your ear holes, we hope, are pleased by what you see, even if your eye holes are not, if you watch us on YouTube. But thank you to our Master of Dungeons Patreon supporters. We very much appreciate everything that you do for us. For the Master of Realm supporters, you fine folks are listed in our show notes. And our Masters of the Multiverse, they get a shout out right now. So thank you, Keith Ammon of The Monsters Know What They're Doing, Lou Anders of Lazy Wolf Studios, Craig Bailey, David Bastiansen, Steve Bissonette, Merrick Blackman, Evil John, Andy Edmonds at nerdronomicon.com, The Mighty Jerd, Ben Heisler and Paige Lightman, Sean Hurst, Brian King, Jim Klingler, aka DM Prime Mover, Chad Lynch, The Mathemagician, Eric Menge, John Mickey, Sean Molly, Falcon Neal, Tom Nelson, creator of the Deck of Player Safety, Mike Olson, Mighty Zeus, Post Fiction RPG Audio, Robert Pasley, Vladimir Prunner from Croatia, Chance Russo at Drago Russo, Ross Sandberg, Andy Shockney, Krishna Simon Say, Jeremy Talloman from the D&D and TV podcast, Trace, Joe Tyler, James Walton, Graham Ward, Javier Wasiak, and Chris Webster. Thank you so much for your support. You can become a patron of the show and support our efforts here by going to patreon.com/masteringdnd. You make our face holes smile. If you get a chance, you could also review us on Apple Podcast or wherever you listen to this podcast. Give us those five beautiful stars to let everyone know that you're enjoying the show. You can also subscribe via YouTube so that everyone out there knows what we do. Teos, where can people find your work?
Ooh, find me at alphastream.org. From there, you can get to all my stuff, including this week. I'm going to have a video up for the Lore of Neverwinter, where they have a new Spelljammer expansion, and they have some shenanigans and some really cool scenery to inspire anybody who's running a Spelljammer campaign.
Nice. You can find me on all the socials at Sean Merwin, and you can follow the show on the socials at Mastering D&D. I want to thank Chris Nizak, who hosted me in another Daggerheart show on the Misdirected Mark podcast. So it was great talking about that, and you can check out that show at Misdirected Mark. So Teos, we have gotten through the player side of things, and we're getting now into the nitty-gritty of Daggerheart. So what should we do now?
I'm going to contemplate whether if everybody plays a ranger and deals stress damage to a monster, making them vulnerable, where they can just live with always attacking with advantage. All ranger party. Who's with me?
And I'm going to contemplate breaking the game in some other ways as we go forward, but I'm not
No?
gonna talk
Secret?
about that now. No, it's a secret. My lips, except for the fact that they're flapping, are
Are
sealed.
sealed.